Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. The official response to terrorism in the past has ranged from diplomatic isolation, as of Syria from time to time, to trade embargoes, as against Libya, to slashing reprisals, as in the American missile attacks on Afghanistan 2 years ago, answering the car bomb attacks on our embassies in Africa. The Lockerbie trial, just underway in Holland, is an effort in another direction. It's an attempt to find individual perpetrators responsible, in this case, for mass murder under the law. It's a complicated construction in this Lockerbie case, with an Anglo-American prosecution against two Libyan suspects before three Scottish judges in a courtroom on a Dutch airbase. The more fundamental anomaly here is that while the Libyans charged with this bombing are pictured as intelligence agents of their government, the trial focuses just on those two men, not on the Libyan state or the man who runs it, Colonel Gaddafi. So, a popular theory of the Lockerbie disaster may never be tested here, the theory that the bomb on Pan Am 103 bound for New York 12 years ago was Gaddafi's revenge for the Reagan-era raid on his quarters that took the life of one of his children. Connection listeners, do you see a credible model in the Lockerbie trial for a criminal judgment on terrorism? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking about the bombing of Pan Am 103 in 1988 that landed on the Scottish town of Lockerbie. Our guest in the studio, Michael Scharf, is a professor at the New England School of Law. He was counsel to the State Department's Counterterrorism Bureau during the Lockerbie investigation. Also with us by phone, Mark Zaid is a lawyer representing 40 families in a civil lawsuit against the Libyan government. The suit was filed in the United States. Michael Scharf, get us started. What sort of a model in international justice is this Lockerbie trial going to be? It's going to be the most expensive prosecution that the British government has ever mounted. It could go on for a year. What sort of result are we hoping for?
Let me start by contrasting this with what happened when I was at the State Department and Iraq was accused of trying to assassinate former President George Bush when he was in Kuwait. If you remember, the United States went to the Security Council of the United Nations. They did a dog and pony show where they showed in closed session some information that they had gotten from wiretaps, CIA intercepts, sources and methods. And they convinced the members of the Security Council that the United States had the right to act in self-defense and bomb Baghdad. Now, that should be contrasted with what we're seeing in this trial. In this trial, the prosecution cannot use the secret CIA information that might be the most important information linking Gaddafi and the Libyan intelligence agency to this bombing, because the judge of this trial says that there can be nothing done in closed session where the defense and the defense counsel does not get to see and cross-examine the evidence. Also, there are some weird things about Scottish justice that are going to make it hard for the truth to emerge from this trial and for a verdict to be such that the families who have lost loved ones will be happy with it. One is something called the two-source rule. In Scottish justice, unlike the United States, there can be no conviction unless every important element of the crime has been corroborated by more than one source of evidence. So no matter how persuasive an individual who may have been an eyewitness is, that's not enough unless you have a second source. And then the third thing is, in Scotland, they have a very strange system of verdicts. In the United States, we have two verdicts, guilty and not guilty. In Scotland, they have guilty, not guilty, and a third verdict called not proven. And what that essentially means is that the judges thought there was some evidence of guilt, but not beyond reasonable doubt. So as a compromise, they say the case was not proven, and then the world never knows whether the individuals were guilty or not. What we're going to see in this trial are two stories. The prosecution story is the one where the two individuals were responsible for putting on the bomb. The defense has a different story. They say that it was a Palestinian group operating out of Syria that put this bomb on. And if we don't have a conviction at the end of the trial, we'll never know the truth.
You say there can be no secret CIA information. They can't just go into chambers and say, here are the goods. Can there be open testimony, and won't there be, of CIA government intelligence?
Right. Well, that then is the question. If the United States wants to use its let's say it's operatives that have been operating in Libya successfully, or it's wiretap information that the NSA has developed, that usually is something the United States is disinclined to use because it can put people's lives at jeopardy and it can show enemies what our abilities are in terms of intercepting information. But if they really want a conviction in this case, they're going to have to weigh that carefully, and they might have to put that evidence publicly on the stand.
Speak to this contested question about whether there's a deal exempting Colonel Gaddafi. The Libyan government had a hand in producing these defendants for trial. Was there or wasn't there a deal that said you won't get at the master of everything that happens in Libya, right, Colonel Gaddafi?
Okay, well, there certainly was a deal that ended up allowing Gaddafi to turn over the two Libyan intelligence officers. The deal that has publicly been acknowledged is that there would be a lifting of the sanctions, and that actually has occurred with Resolution 1193 of the United Nations Security Council. They also said as part of the deal that there had to be a nonstop flight to the Netherlands for these individuals, and that there would be a trial at Camp Zeist in the Netherlands, and that way the United States couldn't snatch them and try them in the United States. Further, if they're convicted, they're going to be in Barlini prison in the Netherlands, and the deal is that the UN would have monitors in that prison for as long as they're there, and finally that the Libya would be allowed to have a consulate in Edinburgh right near the prison so that these individuals' interests could be represented. That is the public deal. Now, the secret deal is something that has been long suspected. Kofi Annan's letter of August 88, which sealed this deal, has not been made public. And a lot of people have asked for it. Congress people in the United States have. The families of the victims have. The United States, Great Britain, and the United Nations refuse to turn over that letter. And what people are suspecting is that further part of the deal is that they would keep Gaddafi out of this case. Now, my own belief is that it is just as likely that the deal would be that there would be most favored nation status for Libya and that there would be full resumption of trade between the United States and Libya as keeping Gaddafi out of the case. I think that's a little bit far-fetched to suspect. But the United States and the other authorities are misplaying this one. There's no reason not to make this letter public.
Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the Lockerbie trial of the bombing of Pan Am 103 in 1988. Two Libyans on trial before Scottish judges and an Anglo-American prosecution. Mark Zaid is on the line. He's a lawyer representing 40 of the Lockerbie families in a civil suit in the United States against the Libyan government. Mark Zaid, what are the prospects of a civil trial here, and how are they different?
They're very good, Chris. We first filed the case back in 1993 against Libya on behalf of Bruce Smith, and that's since grown to include most of the American families in here. We're in the Eastern District of New York in federal district court. At first, there was sovereign immunity protecting Libya. Every foreign country has essentially absolute sovereign immunity unless an exception can be met. We litigated it. We lost, actually. Instead, we went to Congress and we changed the law. We literally stripped Libya of its sovereign immunity, and that's where we are now. The case is going fairly slow because of the ongoing criminal case, but we may very well see an O.J. Simpson type of justice. We are not planning to go forward contingent solely on the criminal case. The criminal conviction would be fantastic for us, but if there is an acquittal or a not proven verdict, our case still continues. And the key distinction, of course, to note is the criminal case is against the two individuals, while the civil case, although the two individuals are defendants, the civil case is primarily against the Libyan government.
The O.J. parallel is of the public criminal trial that in the O.J. case couldn't convict, and the private damage civil suit, which did reach an enormously punishing judgment against them. That's what you mean?
Exactly. It is, our success is not entirely contingent on a criminal conviction. It would be facilitated by a criminal conviction, but we do not have to rely upon that. We can go forward regardless with a much lower burden of proof by which to attain what we have sought for for 7 years and altogether for 12 years almost, is accountability of the actual truth.
But now, are the two defendants in the state trial in Holland on your list of defendants, and how differently do you target the government of Libya and Colonel Gaddafi?
There are five defendants. Two of them are the two individuals, although they have never made a personal or otherwise appearance. The other three defendants are the state itself, the intelligence agency, and the Libyan State Airlines. Those three entities have appeared. They've been in the case for 6 years. They've actively and aggressively litigated within, so they've been a very significant participant. And we have targeted Libya in the sense of we would be able to produce evidence that would demonstrate not just the culpability of the two individuals, but the culpability of the Libyan government leadership. So we would go straight to where the criminal convictions, in fact, if you read the indictments, lead, straight up to the chain of command, up to Colonel Gaddafi himself.
What is the prospect, in your view, Mark Zaid, of criminal justice and civil justice as a real remedy against terrorism?
Well, I think it's an excellent way to pursue. Typically, governments have been a little leery about civil justice. They feel, I know the United States does in most cases, that terrorism is an act or attack against the state, and the state should take care of it. As Michael Scharf explained in the beginning, this case is a little bit different because instead of retaliating as we did against Iraq with the attempted assassination on President Bush, we turned this matter over to the Security Council and have not taken the opportunity to pursue it state to state, more of UN to state, which took many, many years to actually get to a point where we might have anything moving forward. And it is just one arrow in the quiver to fight against terrorism. Terrorism is manifesting itself over the years. It's transformed itself. It's much different than it was in the 80s or the 70s or the 60s. And in many ways, this is just one way that we can fight it. And I think it's a good way. And it's been very effective in one significant sense to give the victims a sense of justice.
Ken Dornstein is on the line. He's a television producer who wrote a piece for The New Yorker called Where My Brother Fell to Earth, about his brother who was on that Pan Am Flight 103. It's the stuff of a book in progress. Ken Dornstein, what's your hope of getting to justice or convincing truth about what happened to Pan Am 103?
Well, I think it's complicated, and I think I have a mixed reaction in terms of the trial. I sort of see myself in a kind of post-justice period, at least in terms of the for me, the narrow question of assigning responsibility to somebody. I think there was a time when, years ago, when I was much more attached to the different theories and thought that there was some hope of uncovering things, you know, had justice fantasies about tracking down Ahmed Jibril when he was the prime suspect, or uncovering something in a hotel in Lebanon or something and having some kind of face-to-face confrontation. And I've certainly read accounts from the last week of relatives who have tried hard to make eye contact with the suspects. And I reserve the right to say that if I went to the trial, and I think I will go at some point, that it's all will be meaningful. And maybe when I'm actually sitting there, I'll try to make eye contact too. But from where I stand today, I can't imagine that eye contact being that meaningful, partly because I don't think, and I don't think many people believe, that these two are masterminds in the sense that they dreamt this up and executed it themselves. But I don't know, I don't have a very deep sense of need for retribution, and I think it's partly the fact that I think the truth of how this happened, the circumstances, was complicated to start with. And I think now, so many years later, and with so many political and commercial interests at stake, that it's probably not likely to uncover it. So
what is your sense of the deal with the Libyan government. Is this precluding the whole truth here?
Well, I think it's how you define the whole truth. I mean, I think what I'm saying is
The search for the mastermind, say.
Well, I think what I'm saying is I resigned myself from the search for the mastermind, and I think I resigned myself because it seemed to be something out of my hands. I think there are relatives who are upset that we can't get access to the Secretary General's letter to Gaddafi, but I'm not sure what I'd find in that letter or what I'd find in the statements of 10,000 witnesses and in all the evidence that's going to be introduced at trial. That's really going to help me in the things that I think, at the end of the day, you need the most help with, which is sort of accepting a loss that's irrevocable. I mean, I've already resigned myself to the idea that there's probably not going to be a final truth, and there's no one who's going to confess, and there's not going to be an assignment of responsibility that satisfies me. So I can say that I'm astounded at the extent of the investigation. It was enormous. I'm always surprised at the continuing effort by a lot of people who spent a lot of time making this trial happen, and I think I don't begrudge them that one bit, and I hope it produces something. In terms of the energy I've invested in it, I think that there are all sorts of things you can invest in to find meaning after something, a loss of this kind, and I think I just stopped investing in the legal and political resolution as a kind of, it didn't seem like a good investment.
But that's a family and a brother speaking, not a government, right?
Well, I think it's always been hard to reconcile that. I mean, over the years, if you listen to the statements that the president's made on every anniversary, the language has shifted to the point where it now seems like it's fairly uncontroversial to say that this was not an attack on my brother. I mean, who was he to the Libyans? It was an attack on Americans, which is effectively an act of war. And I think the idea of an indictment as a response to an act of war is novel. I can't say that it feels like justice to me.
Ken Dorsey, could I just ask, you went to Lockerbie in search of something. What did you find?
Well, I think I went to Lockerbie in search of a kind of truth that I could establish. I mean, I think initially I thought, you know, you could establish some kind of truth about who did it, and it was just a matter of diligence, and it was a matter of reading everything. And I think I went to Lockerbie. Finally, this was 7 or 8 years later, I'd read a lot of accounts of people going, and I think I went there thinking I was going to unravel something, thinking I was the Harrison Ford character who was going to be one man against the world, but I think the sort of truth that I really needed to establish, and the only facts that I could really come up with that I thought were incontrovertible were what happened to the plane, how the thousand details of how it broke up, where my brother fell and where other people fell. What was this town like? So there was a sense that I guess I was sort of alienated by the story as a story. You know, I first saw it as news on Nightline, not knowing that that I had any personal stake in it. And so the news, the story of it, and the politics of it, and the legalities of it, I think have proceeded on one track. And I think going to Lockerbie was an attempt to find something true out of all of this that I could establish for myself and that I could live with when news reporters didn't care about this anymore, when there was no longer a legal process ongoing at all or one that people talked about. And I think that the notion of a criminal trial, certainly of this kind, that is closure for relatives. I mean, I don't think that's why, I think it's an overused term, but the idea that the trial is set up for my personal emotional healing, I sort of don't believe. What it is set up for, I think, is an open question, and how it came to be, I think we sort of backed into it. But I think that I put those questions aside and started investing in what I could remember, not of the last things of my brother's life, and I was for a while fascinated with the details of the last things. But it became easier to talk about Gaddafi and to talk about Palestinian splinter groups and different aspects of the trial than it was to think for a second about who my brother was and what the loss was. And I think in some ways, some people, I think you can get so attached to the this drumbeat for justice and truth, and it might not, it might be a limited, a trial might be a limited instrument for personal healing.
Ken Dorsey, and I take your point. I want to ask Michael Scharf about the drumbeat of justice and the drumbeat most especially of truth. Do you believe the details of the government's case? Do you believe in the detective work here?
You know, when I was counsel to the Counterterrorism Bureau for 2 years, from 1989 to 1991, during that entire period of the investigation of Pan Am 103, everybody I talked to in the government, in the Justice Department, in foreign governments, were convinced that it was the PFLP General Command, that's a terrorist group, a Palestinian group acting out of Syria, who was doing this act on behalf of Iran, who wanted retaliation for the U.S. Vincennes blowing up the Airbus. And it wasn't until I left that office and became attorney advisor for U.N. affairs and was no longer responsible for the Counterterrorism Bureau's legal work that the investigation took a very quick and sharp U-turn toward Libya. And there was some evidence that all of a sudden pointed toward Libya, although it's circumstantial and not very strong, but there were other factors going on in the background. This was exactly the point when the Persian Gulf War broke out. Mm. And Iran and Syria were crucial to the success of the Persian Gulf War, whereas Libya was still a rogue state that we didn't need and was an easy target. And in a way, let's talk about the indictment as realpolitik. Ken suggested the indictment as a response to an act of war is an interesting thing. In fact, what the indictment allowed the United States to do is to go to the Security Council and get sanctions imposed on Libya. Libya is now complaining that the sanctions did $70 billion of damage to their economy in the last 10 years. That's a lot more than they would pay in the civil suit to Mark Zaid. That's a lot more than they would have to pay if the United States just bombed them, because, you know, the bombing raid of 86 didn't cost $70 billion worth of damage. That in itself was a very effective punishment. And what it also did is perhaps it ended the cycle of violence that the United States and Libya had been in, where there was a tit-for-tat cycle. The United States did the shooting down of the Libyan MiGs over the Gulf of Sidra. Libya put the bomb in the LaBelle Disco that killed two American servicemen. The United States then bombed Tripoli. And this would have gone on forever. And perhaps this trial, even if it is not going to arrive at the truth, and perhaps especially if it does not arrive at the truth, is the vehicle for repairing the relations between these two countries and for punishing Libya and getting $70 billion worth of revenge in a way that was not an act of war.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Lockerbie connection with a most extraordinary and unusual international trial underway on a Dutch airbase of two Libyan suspects. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. Doris is on the line.
Yes. I live in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts, and my husband and I lost our son, who just became 20, and he was a Syracuse University student doing a semester abroad. Mm. The last person who spoke, I can't go along with him. I have fought for some justice for the loss of my son's life from the very beginning of this. And
how were you able to do it, Doris?
How was I able to do it? I guess my son gives me the strength, because terrorism, first of all, I never, my son was flying back from London, never thought of terrorism. At the time, we lived in Old Lyme, Connecticut, town of 6,000. Air crash, yes. Terrorism, no. And my husband and I are very willing to fight for justice for the loss of his life, and we're not willing to give up. We'll keep going on with this. Do we have much hope? I don't know. But I don't think we've received justice from Libya. And I don't think you can count on what they say, how much they've lost. We are very concerned about the letter. What we think is in the letter is a deal being made between Kofi Annan and Gaddafi and our president and the British government saying that they will exonerate any countries that have been involved with this. And that's why we want to see the letter.
When you ask to see the letter, Doris, what's the government's response?
That we're not able to see the letter. Now, don't forget, our son died on this plane, and we think it should be open to us. But so far, all of us have been given an absolute no.
Do you believe that the two men on trial did it?
Yes, I do. We've spoken to the highest officials in Scotland, and they have told us that they have enough evidence to incriminate these two people. I do believe that. However, one thing we have to realize, none of the evidence so far has come out of Scotland. We have only seen, during the Pan Am trial, Scotland would not give up the evidence because of this trial coming up. So we haven't seen or heard the evidence nor the witnesses that they say they have.
Doris, could we come back to the point after a short break? We're talking about the trial in Holland of two Libyan suspects in the Lockerbie airline disaster in 1988. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Lockerbie Connection. We're talking about the international trial of two Libyan suspects in the 1988 bombing of Pan Am 103. It came down in Lockerbie, Scotland, and killed among the passengers and the Scots on the ground 270 people. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone. Doris, on the line, lost a son on Pan Am 103, returning from a junior year abroad, had got on the plane in London. Doris, I take it from your comments that you think there's a good chance of convicting the two suspects, but there's also a whiff of a cover-up here with respect to the Libyan chief of state, Colonel Gaddafi. Would the conviction of the two defendants be morally satisfying to you?
I guess I'd like to see them in jail because under Scottish law, you know, there's not a death penalty. So, yes, these were only the two perpetrators who put this suitcase aboard the plane. I do want to know who's in back of who sponsored this. However, I may never get that. However, I'm willing to fight for that. We have fought. I don't think anyone that's been affected by terrorism knows what to do in the beginning, but we fought. On the 103rd day, we had to fight to be recognized by President Bush that our son went down in an act of terrorism against the United States. Before then, we did not hear from our government. No letter, no anything. We have fought for airline security legislation, and we have fought for this trial. If it wasn't for our group and for some other victims' families, there would be no trial. There is something wrong here. I mean, I have learned so much about our government, so many things that I don't want to know. Unbelievable. We're willing to fight, though, because terrorism is the number one problem in the whole world now. And if somebody needs to stand up, we need to stand up and tell them about it. Because until it affects you, You'd rather put it out of your mind.
Dara, stand by. Michael Scharf, that's a very disappointed citizen, not to mention a heartbroken mother. Does she have a case?
Well, let me say, having been at the State Department during the time when the government really mishandled the Pan Am 103, dealing with the victims, dealing with the tragedy, and the beginnings of the investigation, I am completely sympathetic and agree with Doris that the U.S. government, she probably learned so many things she didn't want to know about it. But having been in the government, I can tell you, if there's two ways to look at something, as a conspiracy and cover-up on the one hand, or as a major screw-up on the other, 9 out of 10 times with the U.S. government, it's the latter. It's the screw-up. And I think most of what happened in the Pan Am investigation and dealing with the families were of that category. But let me also say, as far as the trial, Doris and the other victims want justice. They want to see the truth emerge. They want to see individuals punished. If I was the prosecutor in this case, I would not have gone forward. And under the Scottish legal system, there has not been a grand jury proceeding. There has not been a probable cause proceeding. So the evidence has never been tested. And what we had last week, or 2 weeks ago, is Andrew Hardy, which was the Lord Advocate General, the person who was going to lead the prosecution team, mysteriously resigning to appoint himself to be a judge, which he could have done after the trial. And everybody who's looked at this thinks the reason he did that is because he knows this is a no-win situation for the prosecution, and he didn't want to be tarnished by it. The U.S. never wanted this trial. They were the country that for years said, no, 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 we don't want a trial in the Netherlands. We won't accept this deal. They called it a bluff, but it wasn't a bluff. It was a real deal. And the reason is, if you look at the evidence, for everything the prosecution has as its major evidence, the defense has an answer. Much of this evidence has now come out. There have been 5 different kiss and tell books in which investigators have talked to reporters and told them the inside evidence. A lot of the witnesses have talked. They've appeared on 60 Minutes and other radio and news broadcasts. So we really do know pretty much what the trial is going to look like and what the evidence is going to be. And what I'd like to do is spend a few moments going through the major prosecution elements and then explaining why it's going to be hard to win.
Stand by. Before we let Doris go, I want to hear from Ken Dornstein about sort of the family perspective here. Does Doris's heartache sound familiar to you, Ken?
I think it does, and the last thing I would do is minimize anyone else's heartache, and the last thing I would want to say is that I'm in any way representative. I think it's been alienating over the years to watch story after story and feel like people might be speaking or people might be talking about it, but they're not necessarily representing your point of view. So I think in one sense I'm grateful. I mean, you can be critical about the quality of justice that might emerge from this, or the prospects for some kind of final truth to be established, which I think are dim. I think when the New York Times reports that invokes the specter of Kennedy assassination conspiracy theories, in the sense that that there are so many competing theories, and they've been trotted out so many different times that it might make you despair of finding one that's going to settle in as the final truth. I mean, I think what I'm saying is that To the extent I had ever invested in getting at some kind of final truth, that I had stopped investing in that and started investing in something else. But
I want to get a last word from Doris, if you have one, Doris.
Well, first of all, I do respect Ken Dornstein's approach, and I've had to reconcile to the fact that we probably will not get justice here, and I live with that and deal with it. However, I guess being the mother and the person I am, I'm going to do everything that I can to bring about justice, still knowing in the back of my mind I may not get it. But also, we are going to Camp Zeiss this June, my husband and I, for a week. And we went down for the beginning of the trial this past Wednesday. I think for me, there'll never be, and anyone who brings up the word closure is on my bad list. There'll never be closure to this. And I don't think we'll ever learn the whole truth. But I think it's something we have to go after. And of course, I think we have to fight terrorism in every way that we can, and that's what my husband and I are doing.
Doris, thank you, and thank you for calling The Connection and sharing so much. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Lockerbie connection. Krister is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Krister.
Yeah. I have, I'm following something quite different. I have a little footnote, I guess, but I think it's important. I saw a picture in the Boston Globe late last week at the opening of the trial, and saw the judges sitting there in white robes with heavy crosses on, and I had a kind of flashback to the Crusades in the Middle Ages, the Knights of the Crusades. And considering this a trial where the defendants are Muslims, I had a question that you can perhaps find out from a caller. Is this the regular robes of the Scottish judges, or were they special for the occasion? And in either case, I think it shows enormous insensibility.
It's a very interesting question. I don't know what judges in Scotland wear on their regular robes. Do you, Michael Sharp?
I do, in fact. What you're seeing is that Scottish justice looks a lot different than U.S. justice. The litigants have to wear black gowns and the white wigs, and the judges are called Lord Sutherland, Lord Cameron, Lord McLean. They wear the white robe with the red embroidered cross, and that is the cross of justice that is known in Scotland in all trials. And it does look a little peculiar, especially to people from the United States who have never seen the appearance of Scottish justice before.
Did it call the Crusades to mind to you?
You know, I hadn't thought of it in that way, and I'm wondering about how this might all be playing out in Libya.
Krister, do you want to guess? I mean,
is there sort of an onward
Christian soldiers theme in that picture?
Yeah, I think it just shows insensitivity in either case. There's nothing more to say. But I'm very grateful to know that this was at least not constructed like the Chief Justice at the impeachment trial, but this is as it usually looks.
Krister,
and yet, I think in the eyes of religious tensions, which really play into so much which has to deal with Muslims, this is very strange indeed.
Krister, thank you for calling attention to that picture. 1-800-423-8255, the Lockerbie connection. Kate is on the line.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kate.
I have a question. The destruction of the plane over Lockerbie was thought to be revenge for two incidents, the Iran Airbus and the bombing of Libya, killing one of Gaddafi's children.
Yes.
Since we're in court now on this case, couldn't those problems have been settled in court before? The American attacks, couldn't the Iranians or the Libyans have brought the Americans to court and settled it?
In fact, Iran has brought...
Michael Sharp.
You know, both countries have brought the United States to the International Court of Justice. And in Iran's case, that case is still going on. The United States has made a gratuitous payment to the families of the victims, but the Iranians believe that isn't sufficient. In the Tripoli case, they also have brought a case before the United States saying that they had a right either to prosecute these individuals themselves or to extradite them, and the U.S. was forcing them by imposing sanctions to extradite, and that was a violation of their international legal rights. And so both of these cases have gone to the World Court. Now, the World Court takes a very long time to dispense with a case. We're now on its eighth and ninth year of these two cases. And so when you're talking about international justice moving slowly, that is the forum where it moves most slowly and is perhaps most frustrating.
Kate, does that do it?
Yes, but I do want to say that these people also have heartache, and we have to think of them, too. Thank you very much.
Kate, thank you for calling. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Lockerbie connection. Michael, you wanted to sort of outline some of the fine points in the prosecution. Go right ahead.
I don't think it's a mystery of what the key elements that the prosecution's case rests on. First of all, they found a bombed suitcase in the wreckage that had the residue of Simtex, which is the plastic explosives. And inside the suitcase was clothes from Mary House in Malta. It actually had a label that said that. So the prosecution team went to Malta, to Mary's house. They talked to Tony Gacci, who is the proprietor of that establishment, and they showed him a picture of McGrahi, and they said, is this the guy who bought these clothes? And they showed him the remains of the clothes. And he said, yes, that's the guy. Now, prior to that photo ID, Gacci said that the person he sold the clothes to was about 50 years old, 6 foot tall, and very heavily built. And McGrahi at the time was only 36, 5 foot eight, and very slight of build. And after the ID, Gacci was then shown by the defense an ID of Mohammed Abu Talb, who is this PLO terrorist who is suspected also of this bombing. And he said, oh, that looks even more like the guy I sold the clothes to. So the first element of their case is going to be very shaky. The second thing that they're basing their case on is the circuit board, which is a little timing device about the size of a thumbnail that they found in an 880-square-mile wreckage trail. And it contained an electronic timer, and under a microscope it said Meebo on it. So they went to Meebo, which is a Swiss electronics firm operating out of Zurich, and they said, who did you sell these timers to? And the director of Meebo, a guy named Edwin Bollier, said, I sold them to the Libyans. Aha, the prosecution said, we've got our case against Libya. Now, he has since given a greater story. He says, I also sold some of these to the Stasi, which is the East German secret police, which was known to be sharing these things with the Palestinian terrorist groups. And he also said some of them were stolen just a couple of months before Pan Am 103, so anybody could have gotten a hold of them. Finally, they have a Libyan defector who's going to be their key witness, who's going to say, I saw FEMA at the airport putting the Samsonite suitcase on the Air Malta flight. Now, this guy is going to get $4 million and a reward for his cooperation. And the State Department, one of my jobs was to create the Rewards for Terrorism Cooperation program. And I thought this was a wonderful idea at the time. Now, looking back at it, I think it may have been a huge mistake because
why?
The defense is going to say this is sort of like, you know, when you're on that show with Rebus Philbin, So You Want to Be a Millionaire. This guy is unreliable. He has $4 million to say whatever the prosecution wants him to say. So it is going to be very difficult in this case for the prosecution to emerge victorious and get a conviction, especially given the strange procedures that Scottish law entails.
Well, Chris,
Mark Zaid?
I have to jump in. Yeah,
please.
I mean, I have to disagree with Michael, who's a close friend of mine. I think it's highly premature to arrive at any conclusion. I mean, I know all the facts, of course, of what Michael's just said, and there's much more detail. Most of the evidence, I don't think, is known from the government level. The books, in fact, that have been written on this case are very outdated. There hasn't been a good book put together on this case since 1992. There's been some that have come out since then, but most of it's been disinformation.
Take one of those flaws in the prosecution, Mark, and give us your own take on it.
Well, look, I don't even think it's necessarily appropriate to go through specific evidence because I don't even want to give, if there's any defense counsel listening out there, that I might produce certain information. But I don't think, for one, it's appropriate to say that because someone might receive a reward, he's unreliable. That's the system of which our government and judicial system is based. We do that all the time. It's not per se unreliability, and there were a lot of other reasons why the individual defected. In fact, the $4 million program, I think, might have been just in its infancy. I'm not even sure if the defector, who's a man named Giacca from Malta, who worked with the suspects, knew about it. There are a lot of pieces of evidence that can be interpreted in different ways, just as the Kofi Annan letter, which, quite honestly, I don't think should be interpreted so sinisterly. Michael has written many letters probably of the same sort, just as any lawyer has written a letter that can be interpreted both ways to satisfy both the sender and the recipients. It's a political legal letter, in my opinion. But the prosecution has over 1,000 witnesses. There's thousands and thousands pieces of evidence that will be introduced. We've only seen 3 days of a trial that will last more than a year.
Yeah, but let me put the spin on it. The prosecution would not have needed to rely on 1,000 witnesses in a trial that is going to be the longest trial ever in Scottish legal history if they had a credible smoking gun. And they thought they had one with the circuit board. They thought they had one with the bomb suitcase. They don't. And so what they're going to try to do is pile all these incrementally, circumstantially guilty evidence on the defense and hope at the end of the day that it all in the aggregate weighs up to a conviction, and it's going to be tough for them.
Stand by. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Lockerbie and the Lockerbie trial connection. Mike is on the line.
Yeah, hi, Chris.
Hello, Mike.
Hi. I would like to tell you about an incident that happened in 1992. I was supposed to fly from Benghazi to Tripoli on December 22nd. And a couple of days before that, all flight numbers of the Libyan airliners were changed in Libya. And on the 22nd, flight 1103 was blown off the air 70 kilometers away from Tripoli Airport. And I guess the government in Libya wanted to blame the Americans who were in the Gulf of Sidra at the time maneuvering and to tell them that, you know, we blew up, you blew up this flight just the same way we did it with Lockerbie, so forget about the whole case. And I have no doubt in my mind that Gaddafi is responsible for the Lockerbie incident also.
Mike, I'm not clear. What was the year of the 1103?
It was 92, December 22nd, 4 days, 4 years to the day from the Pan Am explosion.
Well, I don't get it. Whose airline was 1103?
Libyan Airlines.
And it was
leaving Benghazi, going to Tripoli, and I was supposed to be on that flight. And
you were supposed to be on it.
Yes.
And who else? Who was on it?
Libyan passengers, 159 of them.
I don't get it. This was supposed to be American retaliation?
That's what the Libyan government wanted to make it look like.
Michael Sharp, does this sound familiar?
I've never heard of that case, but what I do want to point out is that the prosecution's other problem is that they have to say either that there was a tremendous coincidence and both the PLO with the assistance of Iran were trying to blow up Pan Am 103 at the same time as Libya, or they're going to lose the case because there's so much evidence that the PFLP General Command was trying to blow up the very flight. 2 months before Pan Am 103 blew up, in something called Operation Autumn Leaves, the Germans found in Frankfurt 5 bombs in Toshiba radios just like the one that blew up Pan Am 103. Mm. Now, the prosecutors say, oh, those were two-speaker radios, or the Pan Am 103 was two-speaker radios, and those were only one-speaker radio. But the similarities are so close, it's going to be hard for the judges to decide that there isn't incrimination in this case and that these two defendants did it.
Well, I have to add to that and clarify it because, Michael, there's no one that I know of, having talked to many in the counterterrorism field, that believe these were simultaneous operations going on. I think you're right. I think many people believe that the PFLP-GC were operating in Germany to blow up American Airlines. So I think American Airlines, in fact, was the flight or the airline that was being targeted at the time.
Mark, stand by for one more caller, would you?
Sure.
Elizabeth is calling from Jamestown, Rhode Island.
Hello, Chris? Hello.
Yes, Elizabeth.
Yes, I'm calling. I've been very interested in the program. In fact, my husband was on board the plane, and we were living in London at the time. And in the aftermath, I was very involved in a lot of the family's political activities.
Yes.
And one of the things that continues to be troubling, there are really two different issues. But the one pertaining directly to the trial, which is taking place in the Netherlands now, is that it's my understanding that the scope of this judicial process is limited to the actions of the two men accused.
Yes.
And that it can go no further. So already, at least from my point of view, the process is very deeply flawed because certainly they weren't the only, if they're involved, they're not the only two involved.
Yes.
And
Elizabeth, we're almost out of time. Make the last point fast.
And the final point is really that, you know, Autumn Leaves and the Helsinki warning and other things, other aspects of this case that have been put out. Everyone in government that I've talked to has worked very, very hard to dissuade me from their efficacy in any way. And the thing that I think that government failed us in is they had a great deal of intelligence prior to this,
Elizabeth,
which they never shared with the public.
We're out of time. Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you, Michael Scharf, Mark Zaid, and Ken Dornstein. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Achieva.com, an online program that guides families through the entire college admissions process. America Online, keyword Achieva. By 10,000 villages, handcrafted gifts from 30...